It's Mareeva and Mareeva's journeying today, and today we're taking a walk across to Australia, Sydney, where we're going to interview Maggie Hamilton. Maggie is a writer, a teacher, a publisher, has a master's degree in English literature, and is an expertise in self-development. Now, Maggie's just put out this beautiful book called What Men Don't Talk About, and we're going to talk to Maggie about this incredible book she's written and for this day and age in this 20th century. Good afternoon, Maggie.
Good afternoon, Mareeva. Great to be with you.
Fantastic, Maggie. I've just had a few people look at this book and some of the articles, and a lot of people are really astounded how you actually tracked these people, the men, from babies to boys to old age, through interviews with scores of different backgrounds, and discovered what men think. Would you like to just tell the listeners a little bit about this, because it's very interesting, Maggie?
Yeah, and it all began actually, Mareeva, with a trip to the movies to see the film The Hours, and a few girlfriends said, you must go, it's a bad girly movie, and I think most women count as a possibility of a spy. So off I went. But the thing that hit me was how, obviously, the women's lives were sad in the film.
We have a lot of static. Hold on. Hello? 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 Anybody there?
We're here.
Is everybody there? Okay, we're getting a lot of static.
Yeah, I hear that.
What would you like to do?
You want me to... thunderstorm. I've got lightning and thunderstorm here.
Oh, then we'll just bear with it then.
Okay.
Okay, we're putting you back.
That's all right. So therefore, I came away from the movie, you know, looking at all the men's lives in the book, thinking, why is it that we don't notice the pain of men? And then a couple of months around that, two marriages, long-term marriages of friends broke up, and they weren't acrimonious. And I did what we women always do. I focused on the girlfriends and their needs because they're vulnerable, they have emotions, they feel. And to my great shock, both men felt abused quite badly. And I thought, what is it that I'm not seeing in that men's lives? So that's when I put together a 22-page questionnaire and started to interview men from Australia and New Zealand, and some of the men are from the States in the book, and to get them to tell me about their lives, what they ache for, what they love, what bewilders them. And I have to say, it was a very shocking experience, heartwarming as well, but shocking because there were so many things I realized that not only myself, but I think most women, and I think a lot of society, we've made all these assumptions about men's lives, and a lot of them, quite sadly, are way off the mark.
Maggie, I think the basis of this and what you said has said that men have had emotional miseducation from boys to manhood.
Yeah.
And this cuts down the emotional level from a very young age, and learning through to the social cues to mask feelings and detach from their own emotions and consciously detach from the emotion of others.
Absolutely.
You could maybe elaborate a bit on this in your findings in the survey with the men from the different age groups.
Yes, because what I started off doing was speaking to adult men, and, you know, although people joked and said, oh, this is going to be a very thin book if it's about men, I found the men were incredibly open, incredibly frank, but every question I asked seemed to pose like 100 more questions, so that's why I ended up beginning the book at the beginning of a man's life, because you don't really understand men unless you take the journey. And, of course, what we do constantly, for the very best of reasons for society, but for quite shocking implications for boys, is that we shut them down from being very tiny. We smack them when they often, or tell them off when they cry. We tell them not to be a baby, not to be a girl. We tell them they're not frightened when they are frightened, and so on. And one famous American psychologist that I quote, Dan Kinlan, he takes that the emotional miseducation of toys, because what happens is that that child from being very tiny gets the message they are on their own, that they have to pretend that they know what they're doing when they're not sure, that they can't ask for help. And a terrible sense of isolation that these children have. And that has huge implications for little boys and grown men, because another thing I discovered was how incredibly cruel boys' lives are. And with the whole violence we're getting through Game Boys and all the other toys now in the videos, boys are seeing more and more violence than they've ever seen before. So when they're in a situation they can't handle, that tends to be the route they take. They lash out. And also they have this view that the world is not a particularly welcoming place. Then you fast forward to teen life, and all that emotion that boys have to do things that are happening around them is no different from girls. The only thing is they're not allowed to express it except with the one emotion, anger, which looks manly. And so that is why we get, you know, teenagers so angry. It is not a normal thing for teenagers to be so angry, but we can see it as that. Then when they get to adult life and get in relationships with women now who are very clear about their needs and what they want, they haven't had 20 years that girls have had playing in emotional landscapes, learning about their feelings, learning to express their feelings, watching sitcoms and all the things that feel, all the kind of girly things that magazines that talk about feelings and how to react in situations. They get into these adult relationships, and women turn around and say to men, you're an emotional cripple. And it's almost like a cruel joke, because of course men are not going to be so able to express their emotions because they've had no practice. And yet what I found, moreover, was that women can scratch beneath the surface and men feel safe. Their emotions and tenderness are just as beautiful and as intricate as a woman's emotions and tenderness.
Definitely. Oh, thank you, it stopped. We've got a storm. I'm sorry for the listeners out there. I've got lightning and a huge storm where I am here out in Arizona. So it just seemed to be calming down, Maggie, so it was a bit of an interference there. But that's fine. Yes, Maggie, I believe this is true in the aspect of mother or father making these young boys not being able to express their emotions.
Yes.
Has caused this big change. But I believe change is on the way. Since you've written this book, I think a lot of people, would you like to tell us about the audiences you've been talking to and how people are actually understanding, especially the women? I
yes.
was interested here in looking at an article in a magazine, women's magazines mainly, like Oprah. We've got Women's Day, we've got Women's World, to see how many articles or photos were stereotyped to men or anything about men. And as I realized, there were probably not even a third in any of these magazines looking at a man in his life or any other stage in his professional life in these magazines. So here in America, there is really, you know, not much on the strong, silent type or of a man in his shell working in his daily life recorded. Maybe you'd like to just tell us a bit about what you found, say, in the age group of the 20 on male.
Absolutely. I think what I asked them about was what they wanted from relationships. And what really blew me away was they're looking for exactly the same things that women are. They talked about having somebody who was there to love them, somebody who'd be there for them, somebody who believed in them, somebody they could share love with, a friend, a lover, all the range of things that women look for. And what really surprised me was that they even used the same language. When I talked to them about the qualities that attracted them to women, and yes, you know, they do love a sexiness to some extent, but certainly not the kind of sexism that I think you know, the kind of Botox and boobs that, you know, that where everybody seems to be rushing out to look like. But what they, one thing they said, which I thought was very interesting, they said they like gentleness in women. And I thought, hang on, what's this about? And it's not about women being doormats. It's about women, they said that they find this constant negotiation that is going on in relationships now where everything kind of has to be debated to the nth degree. They find that incredibly exhausting. And what they loved were women who, you know, in a sense, I think were comfortable in their own skin and, you know, didn't have to turn everything into some sort of debate as to I'm going to do this and you better do that, but, you know, shall we do this? And just able to kind of, you know, cool out a bit more, chill out a bit more and, you know, just kind of relax. And that really surprised me that, again, it's the kind of tender things that men are looking for in women. And this is not meaning that they have to be barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen. There's no sense of that at all.
I noted, Maggie, that one of the young men said that some women actually go out with men to meet their needs, but they haven't looked inside themselves and loved themselves first. And that really brought my attention to, I think it was a young man you named Jason, 22. And the quote was, the woman I've been around to pay too much attention to my emotions, worrying about how I'm feeling, where we're going, they need to be more free and easy and not to worry so much and have love for themselves.
That's right. And a lot of guys spoke about feeling like they were being pinned against the wall in relationships. That, you know, we do have this tendency as women when we want to get something out of a man, forgetting, of course, that they haven't had all these years being able to talk about how they feel and, you know, analysing it to the nth degree that we tend to. And we, if they're not forthcoming, we don't leave it at that generally. We keep going. And, you know, in a sense, it's almost like an emotional violence with towards men because we're so determined to get to the bottom of it. And men find that incredibly suffocating. The another thing that they also spoke about, which I think is very interesting for women in new relationships, and particularly the sort of 20 to 30 year olds, where I guess you've got the majority of kind of new relationships happening, is they hate the way they had to be vetted by all the girlfriends. And they said they felt that was very phony and that it, they felt it was kind of a lack of respect for the relationship and for them that they had to kind of pass the test with all the girlfriends and felt very kind of vulnerable and felt that it really wasn't about the relationship between them and the woman but about them and the whole raft of girlfriends. And really, when you think about it, if a woman had to go through the same process with a man, with all his male friends, then I think that wouldn't be a process that would be particularly appreciated.
Yes, one comment here that I was looking at, which was interesting, Alex, 35, he says, the contemporary man, you know, looking at Sex and the City, well, everybody here in America knows about Sex and the City and Mr. Big, who is very male, but at the same time is nicely finished. He has plenty of polish, but he's not the realistic. Therefore, aren't that many men who are well-read, can play an instrument, be stronger than an ox, but that's the sort of standard. So do you find that that stereotype standard on television shows that we get in Australia and America are what some women are looking for?
Yeah, and I think this is, Alex gave me some wonderful quotes actually. At one point he said it's very hard to be Conan the Barbarian 1 minute and a Renaissance kind of man the next. And they do feel this. And the other thing that they found as well, they spoke to me about as well, is the way that they feel that so many women are quite trying to style themselves on kind of celebrities. I mean, one of the young guys said to me, he said, I'm just so tired of dating, and of course he's talking about he was early 20s, so that's the age group he's talking about, the wannabe Britney Spears. And I think that's what's happened to us with popular culture. Yes, the sitcoms are fun, and, you know, we all love the movies and all that kind of thing, but I have had so many women since the book came out, and it's only been out just a few weeks, as you know, saying to me, you know, how can I pick up a guy in a bar, or, you know, how can I find somebody to love? And what I've kept trying to stress to women is be yourself. And this is the problem. I think, you know, we're so keen on trying to style ourselves to something that isn't real, that we come across as phony to the men we meet. And that, I think, what the men are looking for, certainly from what they've said to me.
I would just like you to give out your email address, and the book is actually written under Viking imprint of Penguin Books, so they can easily go to www.penguin.com.au, and maybe Maggie, give out your website so listeners can go to your website and have a look a bit about you and about what you've done, other books, you've written many other books, and your website, Maggie.
Absolutely. It's www.maggiehamilton.org.
And you can go to Maggie's website and have a look. There is a bit about the book and a bit of synopsis in there, and then about other books that Maggie has written. Maggie, I feel that this was a determining effect on you to say what makes a man tick.
Yes.
And in saying that, we don't find that women now are looking and changing after you've written this book, and as you said, they've rung you, to understand
yes.
more. Instead of saying men are from women are from Venus and men are from Mars, we need to take this a step
yes.
further.
Yeah, and I think Men Are From Mars was a great book at its time, in that I think it did point out that there were certainly major differences between men and women. But I think what's happened over the years, and not just through that book, but through the women's movement, which of course, you know, has had many, many wonderful benefits, but it has got us to look at each other in terms of what keeps us apart. And what I found in the book was that there are so many human qualities we share that need to be loved, to be valued, except that I spoke about before. And what I've found since the book's come out, and I must say I've had an extraordinary response in the talks I've given, often just by telling the stories of the men's lives from a quote, up to half the audience has ended up in tears. And I've had a flood of women come to me afterwards and said, if only I'd realised, you know, they can see the situations that they haven't helped them, because like me, and I think like most of us, we've tended to operate on the kind of stereotypes and anecdotes. And so many of the men have come to me, and I've had a flood of emails saying to me, thank you, you know, for kind of explaining what it is like for us. But also a lot of men who are reading the book, the emails I've got, the relief at realizing they're not alone, because one of the problems with the way we brought up the boys we talked about earlier is that it leads men to believe that whether or not they've got a medical problem, whether or not they're not coping at work, or whether or not their relationship seems shaky, because they have been brought up not to ask for help, they assume that they're the only person who's faced or going through what they're going through, and so they don't get help. And this is, of course, why we end up with the terrible suicide we do.
Yes, that's quite intensive there. I did do a radio program in Australia regarding that, Maggie. Down
yeah.
that coast, New South Wales coast to Grafton area, there was a huge rate of suicidal from, I think it was 18 through to 27. Would you like to just
yeah.
Comment about that, Maggie?
Yes, because I think this is something that, you know, I think we're all still aware of the fact that boys and men suicide, but I think there's part of us that kind of has got used to it in a way, almost as if this is how it's meant to be. And one very interesting thing I found when I did the book, because I do look at a lot of things that are happening in the States, as you know, but when I looked at the kind of world statistics, which I haven't put in the book, but just to kind of get a sense of things, what is interesting is that America, along with Australia and New Zealand, have very high suicide rates. And one of the theories I now have is that we are still, as we are relatively young countries, we are bringing up our boys as if they're still living on the frontier, where, you know, your back's against the wall, you've just got to get on with it. But, of course, the world has moved on, but we're still bringing up our boys as if we're in a different time. And we're bringing up our boys quite differently from boys in different other parts of the world, like Europe, where they are allowed to get promotion and quiet, et cetera. But looking at the suicide thing, what I found was that not only do we have the young men committing suicide, but where there was a spike in the late 70s, early 80s in suicide, that spike has continued on into the men who are now 30 and 40, to 40, and, you know, they have now been called the suicide generation. But two other things I found around suicide, which I don't think most of us are nearly as aware as we should be, and that is that divorced men and separated men are highly susceptible to suicide. Again, because of this inability to ask for help, this feeling of terrible isolation. But also, perhaps most shocking for me was finding that the elder men are very vulnerable to suicide. And some of the best material I got were from suicide experts in New York, who are world suicide experts. And these elder men are killing themselves, often when their wives have died and the family has moved away. And to all intents and purposes, they seem to be coping. And the studies show that often they might have been to a family doctor within the last few days, if not the last 24 hours. And the family doctor hasn't picked up on, you know, just how depressed they are, because, you know, it takes a long time for men to open up. And most, you know, regular doctors, family doctors, are not trained in psychology to pick up the clues. And so we have this whole raft of waves of suicide that are happening throughout men's lives. It affects us all. You know, these are our grandfathers, our fathers, our brothers, our sons, that have a ripple effect throughout the whole of our communities and society.
Yes, it does. And it does ask for wonder why governments and medical departments aren't looking closer at this and asking why, when these people are coming to the doctors, that maybe there is needs to be an emphasis on checking out, because there are normal symptoms that are on depression, but in this age group and these areas, we need to have a look at this. And I believe it needs to start really at the school level, because in Australia, you know, in Sydney, the schools rate as being top schools, Anglican schools down at Rose Bay and these kind of areas where we've got these schools where the children are brought up rigidly, just boys' schools, and it's all boys' fun, games, football and all this. But do we look at the emotional side there in the schools, where we have the religious ministers or fathers, whoever are there, that are with the boys in the school? The aggressivity that happens, and this doesn't have normally in the girls' society, where they have girls' schools as well. Did you have a look into this in any way, Maggie?
Yes, I did. And one of the areas I look at in the book is school sport, because we always say that sport's so good for boys, but in fact there's actually a very dark side to sport as well. And when we have a school educational culture that makes heroes out of boys who are, you know, good at sport, but has nowhere near the regard for the boy who could become an amazing artist, a mathematician, a computer buff, then we're in trouble. And we get that society of kind of two levels of a society in a school. One, the everyday kids who are, you know, just going along doing their studies. And then we get these sporting heroes. And I've actually looked at one particular case study in California where they had a very nasty incident where the group of sports jocks ended up sexually molesting and doing all sorts of things to girls in their community. They basically had a competition to see how many girls they could lay. And the awful thing was, and I'm sure many listeners are probably aware of this case, the awful thing was that it all came out. The, you know, some of the fathers actually felt this was a good thing and they were just being red-blooded males. But, you know, it's that, and that of course then translates to adult sports stars who end up, you know, sexually assaulting women, trashing hotels, you know, being dangerous to be around. And so we really have to look at, again, it goes back to this whole thing of giving boys a much more balanced way of expressing who they are.
Are you there? Yeah. Go ahead. You just broke up. You there? Go ahead.
Yes. To not, with boys, allowing them absolutely to be good sportsmen, but also allowing that other things are also very valuable to not only to particular boys, like the ability to be an artist or scientist, as we were talking about before, but also that those qualities are also really important to our society. But this isolation that boys get because of the violence means that they start to see the world as unsafe, and that is how they react. And this is why we have boys going to school, you know, with knives and guns and all that those things, which are very worrying. And what I found when I was talking to teenage boys, you know, they'd tell me the most horrendous incidents that had happened to them, as if this was just kind of normal, you know, kind of really serious cruelty. And I'd say to them, you know, but you've got mum and dad, or mum or dad, or whatever their situation was, and, you know, you've got teachers. And every one of them, Mareva, said to me, regardless of whether they came from a fairly poor suburb, a neighbourhood, or, you know, an affluent neighbourhood, every boy I spoke to said, no, there's nobody who can help me. This is up to me to sort out. And I think that is a real indicator of also why boys get into trouble and why boys suicide, because they don't ask for help.
It's, I think, a call that you've written out that psychologists need to look at now and turn around, and we need to have these people activating in schools. Psychologists need to be part of a school because they need to be there to actually, I believe, help change this way that society has created a male image. And I want to look at this now, getting the right look. This is a huge factor, I believe, with a lot of young men, and you wrote a whole chapter about this, In Search of the Perfect Body. We're going to be going to a break in a minute, so maybe we can just talk about this a few minutes and then we'll be having the break.
Yeah, this is another area that really surprised me, was just how much body image is having an effect on boys and men now, and also male eating disorders, particularly the eating disorder which they call bigorexia, which is kind of like the reverse of anorexia, when these guys are incredibly pumped up. You know, they're on steroids, they're working out several hours a day, this is boys and men. But when they look in the mirror, they see, you know, a body that it hasn't had any kind of body sculpting, and so that makes them, you know, work even harder.
Is there?
Can you hear me?
And go ahead.
That they're eating massive amounts of protein a day, they're exercising to ridiculous amounts, they won't go out to restaurants often because they're worried they might not get the right kind of food. They, even though they've got these pumped-up bodies, they often wear baggy clothes, even in summer, because they're ashamed of their bodies. And this is very much seen as related to the rise in the sudden interest in male bodies. But, you know, as you say, now in magazines we're getting lots of photographs of male models, you know, wearing skimpy clothes, and they've all got to have a six-pack. And this is really becoming quite a problem now with boys and with men. Even in the armed forces, they're having this problem because, you know, obviously fitness in the body is something that's concentrated on there.
You quote in the book the television series Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, which came out in 2003.
Yeah.
Alarmingly, her youngest male client was 13. Outside the beauty salon, male cosmetics and toiletries are now an increasingly important part of the cosmetic sales worldwide. Well, I should think they should be. Why shouldn't men be able to put cream on their body and go and have Botox put into their facials? I don't see the difference. You quote this, Maggie, here, and
yeah.
Also the Associate Professor Wendy Seymour, as you've just said, in the West, we live in an advanced capitalist society where the creation of desire and need is a key driver in the socioeconomic system. But in order to create a sense of need, capitalism must also create a sense of dissatisfaction. Mass media, modern marketing, and other agencies construct and promote an ever-changing ideal of our physical perfection.
Yeah. And look, I think it's wonderful that men take care of their skins and, you know, have deodorant and all that kind of stuff. I think the thing is that feeling that you're not good enough is the thing that is worrying. And I think there's a difference between trying to look your best so that, you know, there's a general sense of a greater well-being and a terrible anxiety that you're never going to measure up. And I guess it's the terrible anxiety that I've looked at. I mean, what's really interesting is that I've given in the book the indicators for parents for boys, because what happens if boys start to bodybuild or get in and are starting to go down the steroid route is that they actually, that parents often feel it's great that their boys have hearty appetites. Unlike girls who, when they're anorexic, they're not eating, it's very easy for parents to pick up on that. To pick up on that particular eating disorder is much more difficult because it just looks like a hearty boy, you know, kind of growing boy eating plenty of food and that's good. But what they found in a number of research studies that I looked at is that there is a definite correlation between boys who are looking at health magazines, sports fitness magazines, those kind of health magazines, and body image dissatisfaction. And that's where then we get, you know, they get into the steroids and, you know, the whole thing starts to get out of hand. To the point that, and I quote a study, and I just can't remember where one of the boys concerned was. I think it was Wisconsin. He was actually at college, and he was doing so much weightlifting and exercise that he actually had a heart attack and died because, you know, the pressure that is put on these boys' bodies when they bulk up with the heart and everything else. You know, he basically had organ failure and died.
Wow.
And I tell his story.
This is incredible. You do say currently around 1 million men in the United States suffer from eating disorders.
Yes. Yeah. And they do say, and if you talk to experts, they actually say that is only the tip of the iceberg because they're only the people who are getting some kind of professional help. And as we know with a lot of these things, you know, particularly if people aren't aware they really have a problem or if they feel comfortable, which of course is the other problem we get back to again with men, at seeking help, then, you know, you don't really have a sense of how big the problem is.
Yes, I'm sure that in both societies, in Australia and in America, this is something that we need to look at. Help for men. There are a lot of help for women. There's all these women's magazines, as I've just quoted,
yeah.
But there aren't men's magazines where men or there are availability of counsellors or someone that they can go and talk to, because I suppose it's like a never-ending merry-go-round. When they get onto the steroids and then they want to have this body fooled and it's all full of drugs and exercise and everything else to maintain themselves, it's hard to stop that.
That's exactly right. And I think the thing is, one of the things that I'm hoping to come out of the book, and it is starting to happen actually with a number of care groups and professional groups, is that that I think we need, as you say, we need professionals to be putting more pressure on. I do think actually professionals have tried, you know, certainly from the experts I've talked to, they've tried hard. But I think hopefully with my book and books that will follow, if, you know, the person in the street kind of can grasp this themselves, then we can start to look for these things in our own families, you know, the little boys in our families, to see that we start to change things for them, to watch them as their teenagers, to look for those signs to make sure they're not going down the route of depression or violence or both. That, you know, if we do have friends or family where there are breakups and we can have a relationship with the men in that situation, that we don't just take it for granted that they say that because they say they're okay, they are. And similarly for our old men, that we can keep an eye on them.
It's definitely public education. We need to address this somehow through media, through teachers, parents and family, so that they can be aware of these systems, and through culture, because it's increasingly that boys are being controlled of how they look and how they should be from the probably idols that we see in Hollywood.
Absolutely. And I think the thing is, Mareva, and I think this is why the women have taken to the book, is because, you know, we all want better relationships, whether it's relationships with our sons, brothers, you know, our partners, you know, fathers. And that once we get what it's like to be inside a man's skin, so much becomes obvious to us. You know, to how to react and not to react to situations in a way that can be beneficial for us all. And I feel that as a result of that, it really will give us the much richer relationships that we deserve. I mean, I'm amazed at the number of young mothers who've said to me, you know, who are very contemporary women, young women, who've said that it has change forever the way they're going to bring up their little boys, because what they hadn't realized was that they were basically parenting their little boys the same way they had seen their brothers parented. You know, that all that stuff we were talking about at the beginning, you know, telling them off when they cry, not listening to them when they say they're frightened and scared. And they're now making an effort to say, one woman who's a journalist said to me, she said, Maggie, I now sit down with my son. If he says he's frightened, I ask him why. And she said, then I say to him, now you're not to worry about that, because, you know, mum and dad were frightened at your age by that. And that's okay, you know. I mean, and those things then reassure a little boy, A, he's not on his own, and that he can talk to somebody about it and get help and move on.
One of the chapters you talk about is why men choose to stay in abusive relationships with women who are abusing them. I felt this very interesting. I really feel that this is something a lot of people may not realize, that they do stay there in these relationships. Maybe you could comment a bit about that chapter.
Yes, I mean, this is a very controversial thing, but I felt I had to put it in because of the number of people I'd spoken to. And this is about, we talk about domestic violence towards women, and that's a terrible thing. And, you know, I think increasingly our societies, communities are working on that. But the big silence still is domestic violence towards men. And this is, to me, it's a bit like the whole pedophile situation. When you and I and other mature people were growing up, Mareva, the concentration was always to keep little girls safe, because we felt that little girls were the only ones who were vulnerable to pedophiles. And, of course, in more recent times, we've learned this isn't the case. And because we didn't know that, hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of little boys ended up being sexually abused. And I feel it's the same thing with domestic violence towards men. I wasn't really aware that this existed, I had to say. But when you start to go into the studies, it is really quite shocking. The number of men who are subject to quite often quite terrible physical violence. And these are not, you know, necessarily small men. Not that there's anything wrong with being small, but these are often men who, you know, can be quite a lot bigger than their wives, and who get beaten, who get their hair pulled, you know, who've had knives pulled on them, all sorts of things. And these men, of course, they often, A, because they feel so deeply ashamed as a man that this can be happening to them. The main reason they stay is that there's children. They will not leave their children behind. And like a lot of women in that situation, they're worried that they're going to be able to cope if they leave with the kids. And I spoke to one guy here who works in the court, and he actually said to me that he was amazed too at the number of men that this happened to. And he said the worst case he came across was that a woman who made her partner live in the shed, and he had to ask permission to come into the house to use the toilet and, you know, to kind of have a shower and that kind of thing. And since working on that part of the book, I have had 4 people in my immediate circle of friends admit to domestic violence within their families. One, it was their partner, his previous girlfriend used to hit him, and he's a builder. Another one, it's her brother, and her wife routinely hits him, you know, quite violently, and he won't leave because of the kids. One professional couple, the wife hits him continually, and another one, it's the son. And the desperation these people feel, but the men feel such shame that they will not seek help most of the time because they feel like they're failures as men. And when they do go to speak to police so often, they're not believed.
And so that's really society, again, putting its quota in there, because, I mean, if you go down and say you're being offended and it's not the way society thinks, society doesn't want to take you on and doesn't want to believe you.
That's right. So, again, where'd you go? And it gets back to, again, this isolation that men feel. And this is the same all over the world. The one professor who I quote, he actually has done a big study in Austria and Germany with men there. And another person I quote briefly, an American professor who is part of an international group that looks at all kinds of violence, and he did a huge study across a whole lot of countries. And he reckons that it was something as high as 40%, I think he said, of the cases of domestic violence were actually domestic violence towards men. And it's really something, again, that it's shocking because it's something most of us are not aware of.
I'm just going to express to my listeners here, we have a huge storm happening here in Arizona, so it might be coming through quite crackling, but we're having a huge thunderstorm and lightning, so that's why we've got a bit of interference. Maggie, what happened to the chemistry? A surplus of women in the United States. The 19th century America, men of marriageable age outnumbered women, in part because the immigrant stream was heavily male and because many young women died in childbirth. Changes in immigration and mortality now mean that the reverse is true. In 1890, there were 107 males for every 100 females, and in the 20 to 44-year-old group, but in 2002, the ratio has dropped to 98 per 100. So what's happened to the chemistry, Maggie?
I haven't looked at exactly what's happened in terms of ratios of men to women, but what I have looked at is just what's happening in contemporary relationships and the inability of people to have long-term relationships. And one of the studies that which I think causes the angst, because often it's not just that there's not enough men to go around, it's that we keep changing partners and we run out of people to kind of, you know, have a relationship with, because everybody's kind of, you know, in this constant flux all the time. And a couple of studies that I ended up not putting in the book, just because of the amount you can put in, that have been done in the US showed that, well, first of all, that a lot of the reasons now why people are splitting up, most of the separations and divorces, I think it's commonly known, are now initiated by women. And for most of those reasons, it's not because of violence, abuse, or anything serious like that. It's the boredom factor, because we're all expecting our lives to, you know, be like sitcoms. And when it's not as glamorous and as exciting, we tend to move on. But what it showed was, and one was a long-term study done over 20 years in the States, it showed that most of the people who got divorced, it was a kind of low-level irritation factors. And that they looked at couples over 20 years, those who divorced and married again, or in some cases married a couple of times, what they found was that the second and third, fourth relationship actually wasn't better than the first one. It was just different, which is quite interesting. And then another professor, Linda Smolik, and I just forget whereabouts in the States Linda's from, but she looked at the divorce factor, and what she found was that those who had divorced, after about 12 to 18 months, that's when they would often hit a really quite seriously depressed time and kind of wonder why they'd done what they'd done. And she found that those who actually, when she first interviewed them, might not have been having the best time in their relationship, going through a rocky patch, those who kind of worked through that were so much more happy than those who were either on their own or were in their second or third relationship. So in other words, it was almost like the rocky time, if you can work through that, it takes you to another level of enjoyment of being around each other. And whereas those who are starting off in another relationship, you know, they're kind of having to deal with all the ongoing basics that you do with a new relationship after the first flutter of romance.
There is also the part of men and sex in your book, and regarding, yeah. I think that the sexual liberation may get people too focused on sex too soon in a relationship, so that when they come up for air, they finally take a good look at the other person and find that they don't have all that much in common, but the relationship limps along anyway, going nowhere. This was quoted from Gregor Counselor. Would you like to just comment a bit on that? We've got another couple of minutes.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think there's no doubt that sexual liberation has been good in many ways, in that, you know, women understand, you know, just the girls understanding about sex and not going into a marriage not understanding that, which I'd have thought would have been quite scary in some ways. However, I think that what was interesting, the number of men who spoke to me about the yearning for intimacy in relationships, and again, going back to the way we bring up boys, if we concentrate totally on sex, then it's very easy for men to assume that, you know, having sex is intimacy, and when in fact there are a whole lot more nuances to that that enrich a relationship that we don't have if one isn't able to work on those lovely textures in a relationship that include sex, but not totally. And because we've come to emphasize totally, you know, the 1001 sexual positions that we should all be using, that the experience of sex is almost like a performance and not an expression of two people loving each other and caring and tenderness and all that. And as Greg, the counsellor who I spoke to, said, he finds again and again, you know, he gets lots of women coming to him saying that, you know, we're having great sex, but there's kind of nothing else there. And a number of psychologists that I've looked at their work have said exactly the same thing, that, you know, the number of people who often come in with relationship problems or who are ready to leave have a great sex life, in fact. We always assume that, you know, they have the sex life is no good and that's why they're parting, but it's because there's nothing else in the relationship outside the bed.
One quote here says, "Don't get me wrong, we need you. We need your love and acceptance. Men do want women's bodies, but most want more than that. They want love."
Yeah, yeah. And there's another guy I quote, who's Kent, who's an American guy, who said a beautiful thing. He said, you know, we do want sex. He said, but most of all, he said, we want to be touched and to be held. And again, I thought that is just so like what we as women want. You know, we don't want a relationship that's just about sex. We want to be held. And I think he said held tenderly. We all want that as human beings. And I think that's where, you know, the kind of emphasis on, you know, how to have the best orgasm ever, you know, all that kind of thing, it just misses out on that need to have the intimate aspect of a relationship and the fun and all that.
We're just coming up to a close here, but there was one thing that I loved, and that was becoming a dad. I love this aspect of looking at the dads, because the dads out there forgotten once the baby's grown up and they go back to work. Would you like to just quote on that, and then we're going to be closing?
Yes. There was just one beautiful thing that I didn't realize how much fathers love their kids. That was a big thing, and what really moved me was a number of young men who had their first baby and they'd had a few days off to be with that baby, who said to me they physically ached to be with that baby when they went back to work. And they said, you know, our love is being at work and providing the income to, you know, to create that safe home. But they said, you know, Maggie, to do that, we have to miss out on the first word, the first step.
Do you know that in Maggie, in Sweden, the father is allowed to take maternity leave?
Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic.
That.
That's the only country in the world, Sweden.
And we really need this, I think, because once we understand, another guy said, when he's in computing, has a big job in computing, and he said he gets up in the middle of the night, and he doesn't care if his little boy cries for an hour. He was 6 months. And he said, he's lying there in my arms, and he said, he's so cute. And he said, all I can think of is that song, "He's Not Heavy, He's My Brother." And these were the kind of expressions the men used to me all the time. And I felt, how is it, you know, I've worked in publishing, I travel the world, I do all these things. How is it I did not know that men could love their children so much?
Maggie, it's been incredible talking to you. I'm sure the listeners are going to send you some emails and ask for this book. It's, I think, needed in all these institutions and medical institutions, and teachers need to read this book. We as a society need to be more aware of how we contribute to this sort of isolation in the way we raise boys and through our ignorance of the impact of culture of violence which has on our boys. Suicide, we've talked about that, and I believe that it's going to give women a good understanding, and that's this role that you put out there, saying that women now are going to listen to love and listen to intimacy and listen to what their other partner or their father or their son is saying and give them the love and the nurturing that is required. Lovely speaking to you, Maggie.
You too, Mareva.
All the best. And What
Thank
Men
you.
Don't Talk About by Maggie Hamilton, author in Sydney, Australia. You can go to her email address, www.maggiehamilton.org. Thank you, Maggie.
Thank you, Mareva.
Bye-bye, listeners, from Mareva's Journey.